God bless you, church family. May the Lord reward your efforts for coming out tonight to study through the Old Testament with me. We're going to take chapter 3 of Joshua, and we'll do chapter 4 not next Wednesday, but two Wednesdays from now, because we are going to be canceling service next Wednesday. So that's your first announcement. First time hearing it, you'll hear it on Sunday as well. No service this coming Wednesday. Two Sundays from now, we'll do chapter. I wish I felt confident that I was the kind of Bible teacher that could do chapter 3 and 4 tonight, because these chapters really do go together. They tell one full story, and it's really a little bit terrible to do chapter 3 tonight, stop for 2 weeks, come back and do chapter 4, but that's exactly what we're going to do. So we'll do a good brush up 2 weeks from now before we head into chapter 4. Right now, chapter 3, it's two fighters sizing each other up before the big fight. In this corner, Israel is looking across the Jordan River at Jericho and reasonably positive about what's coming, which is unusual for the nation of Israel, almost unprecedented. But they're growing in their faith a little bit, this second generation. And, you know, they're kind of ready for what the Lord is about to do. And in the other corner, you have Jericho, who is melting away in fear. That's what we studied last week. Their faith in Israel's God is even bigger than Israel's faith is in their own God. They know that they don't stand a chance in the fight that is most certainly coming, as they have watched for the last several months across the Jordan River, the nation of Israel sitting there, probably in their minds, sizing them up and getting ready to pounce. From the 10 plagues to the parting of the Red Sea, all the way up to the recent overthrow of major military superpowers, Israel's God has never failed them, and the nations around have been watching that. They've been hearing the stories, getting the updates. Jericho has no doubt seen the results of Israel's warfare right there around the region of Moab prior to entry into the land of promise. So you would think that for Jericho, there's really nothing greater that would be needed to weaken their self-confidence and drive them even deeper into fear. Yeah, that is exactly what the Lord does in chapter 3 and chapter 4 of Joshua. This is the nation of Israel and its impossible crossing of the Jordan River. It would position Israel in Gilgal, right by the walled city of Jericho. And seeing what happens, once this event is over, it is just icing on the cake for Jericho. Now, in preparation for these coming studies, I watched through the entire VeggieTales video, Josh and the Big Wall, just because I wanted to have something to fact check my theology with. And surprisingly, what I found out was that the VeggieTales version is not quite theologically sound. I know, collective gasp, we're all surprised. In the VeggieTales version of this, they depicted the people of Jericho, represented by a guy, Jean-Claude and Philippe. And they depicted them as being confident, arrogant, and mocking Larry the Cucumber and the nation of Israel. Well, the fact is that is theologically incorrect. Jericho's inhabitants were terrified of Israel, and they just absolutely knew that they were going to be defeated by the nation of Israel. And to take that a step further, in my fact-checking, I cannot find in the Bible a member of the nation of Israel named Larry the Cucumber. I don't know about Jean-Claude and Philippe, but I'm pretty certain about Larry the Cucumber. Now, with that important correction aside, let's go ahead and now plunge into the depths of chapter 3 and see how the Lord kept his people from plunging into the depths of the Jordan River. Verse 1. Then Joshua rose early in the morning. That tells us right away he's definitely not a teenager. Teenagers don't do this. And of course, we know Joshua is 85 years old here. And he rose up early in the morning. That's a pattern that you'll see with Joshua. You'll read about this a lot, rising up early in the morning to seek the Lord or do the Lord's will. You read that a lot about David. You read that a lot about Jesus. Oh my, the list goes on. The wonderful examples that we study and desire to emulate from Scripture. Usually they are people that rose up early in the morning and begun their day by seeking the Lord and doing His will. But Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. How nice of you to join us, Jason. Thank you. Hope we didn't keep you from anything. All right, verse 1, we just read it. Don't forget what you already do know. Take what you already do know and combine it with what we just read in verse 1. When you do that, I think what you're going to see is that already in verse 1, a God thing is happening. Israel has already been very close to the Jordan River across from Jericho for several months. We've been talking about that since what? Chapter 22 of Numbers, I believe. They've been sitting there for a long time, but Joshua has just had the whole nation pack up their tents, pack up their belongings, scooch over a little closer to the Jordan River, plop themselves down again, set up camp, and when we read verse 2, we're going to find out that they would spend 3 days right there at water's edge, the Jordan River. Now, that is a lot of hassle to go through just to scooch a little bit closer to the Jordan River. They were already close. They were in Shittim. They were already close. And Joshua has them go through all of this work just to scooch on over to water's edge, set up camp again, and then stick around there for 3 days. And what is actually genius behind this move, and I assume that Joshua was led of the Lord to do this. Either way, it is genius. What really is taking place here is that Joshua, probably through the direction of the Lord, is going to have Israel in a spot where they can get the absolute best view possible of the Jordan River for 3 days. For 3 days, they're going to be staring at the impossible obstacle right in front of their faces. And for 3 days, parents are going to have to put up with the kids saying, how are we going to get over there? How are we going to cross, Mom? How are we going to do this, Dad? So for 3 days, sizing up the obstacle, but I got to tell you, that's a positive thing. That's a necessary step in their walk of faith right now. And for those of you who think that God is going to remove all your obstacles without you staring them down for days and weeks and months and even years at times, you've got another thing coming. Because getting the right perspective on the obstacles that are in front of us in life, that helps you get a better appreciation for the intervention of the obstacle mover himself, the Lord. God wants to make sure that you fully first appreciate the impossibilities so that you can then more fully appreciate the God of the impossible who works those things out. Isn't that just wonderful in hindsight? No, not in live action life, I get it. But isn't it wonderful in hindsight? You're sitting there in life staring at your problems for days, weeks, months, years. How's this going to work, Lord? How am I ever going to get past this? How are you ever going to work this out? And then hindsight, you can look back and see how much more grateful you were for God's deliverance or intervention because you sat there and sized up the problem for so long. It is a wonderful correlation there, the sizing up of the problem with the appreciation of the problem solver. It would have been a different story, I think, if they marched from miles away. The wall of water was already up and through they went. But Joshua and the Lord, they say, no, let's sit them down right at water's edge and give them a long, hard time to think about the impossibility of what is coming. Verse 2, at the end of 3 days, the officers at Joshua's command went through the camp, verse 3, and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is going to be mentioned 16 times in Joshua 3 and 4. 10 times it will be referred to as the Ark of the Covenant, 3 times it'll be referred to as the Ark of God, and then 3 times it'll be referred to simply as the Ark. And with 16 mentions, obviously that means this is an important aspect of what the Lord is about to do at the Jordan. This is an important part of God's plan. And to take that a step further, really it signals the coming to fruition of an all-new national dynamic. You have to remember, the nation will no longer be following the cloud by day. They'll no longer be following the pillar of fire by night. That all ceases east of Jordan. I don't know what happened to the cloud and the fire, but it does not cross over with them. So now they are going to be led by the Ark of the Covenant. Now, in the future, they're going to do this differently. When they are mobile in the future, the tribe of Judah is going to lead out, and then the Ark of the Covenant is going to go next, followed by the rest of the nation of Israel. They're going to sandwich the Ark of the Covenant between them. And that's going to be the way of the future. But for this initial thrust into Canaan, the Lord wants the Ark of the Covenant to go first, and then he wants the entire nation to follow the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that is a different approach from what they're used to, and it is very symbolic in its promise. The cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night was the tangible presence of God. That was a supernatural manifestation of God's presence. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is symbolic of God's presence. Remember where the Ark of the Covenant was situated in the tabernacle? It was in the Holy of Holies. It was that third and deepest section of the tabernacle, and only the high priest once a year could go into that section and look at the Ark of the Covenant. But here's what the nation knew. The nation knew this. God said over and over, I will meet you at the mercy seat. I'll meet you at the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. That is symbolic of where God's presence would meet with his people. So they're still being led by the presence of God, at least in the symbolism. But the difference is that it is just that. It is more of a symbolic thing now, whereas before it was a supernatural manifestation of God's glory. And so this calls for a bit of adjustment on the part of the nation of Israel as they adapt to this new manner of travel and adjust from what they were used to and how they used to handle travel. So verse 4 gives us those details. The Lord is saying, you're going to follow the Ark of the Covenant, verse 4, yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits. And we know now that a cubit is 18 inches. It's the length from the elbow to the tip of your pointer finger. And we got well acquainted with the cubit when we were studying through Exodus and Leviticus. Yes, 18 inches. So 2,000 cubits would be 3,000 feet. 3,000 feet in length, that is over a half a mile. That's a big distance. But the Lord says there should be a distance between you and the Ark of the Covenant, about 2,000 cubits, 3,000 feet in length. And then the Lord says, do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. This is uncharted territory for them. They have never been in a situation like this. They have never been in the land that they are now going to be entering. When it was the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, man, that was impossible to miss. No matter where you were in the lineup of the nation of Israel, when the cloud or the fire was leading you, all you had to do was look up. It didn't matter if you were 4'11" and the guy standing in front of you is 7'4". You know, it's that same guy that sits in front of you when you go to the movie theaters. That's him. Same guy. That doesn't matter. Didn't matter where you were in the pack. It didn't matter your height. If you were wondering where the Lord was leading you as the camp was moving, all you had to do was look up. All you had to do was look around. You couldn't miss that giant cloud coming from the nation of Israel. You couldn't miss that pillar of fire during the nighttime. But now that the cloud and the fire are gone, if there were no gap between the nation of Israel and the Ark of the Covenant, here's what would happen. The first few rows of the nation of Israel would see the Ark of the Covenant. And then the next, about half a mile of the nation would not be able to see the Ark of the Covenant. And probably not until you got to the back of the pack, about a half a mile away, would the people then be able to begin to see the Ark of the Covenant. It would be just kind of blocked out by those first handful of rows of people. Well, that issue is fixed by creating this 3,000-foot, over a half a mile long buffer between the people of Israel and the Ark. Sure, you may lose temporary sight of it when you're going around corners or through the woods, but this is going to give all of the people the best chance to have visibility of the Ark of the Covenant and where it is leading them. And that is important because there's an important message that is conveyed in this. And that would be that we are to keep God visible in our life. We are to be looking for His glory, and that should be the aim that we set our sights on. That's the compass point for our GPS in life. So like Paul said, you can follow church leaders to an extent, and that would be to the extent that they are following the Lord. Paul said, follow me as I follow the Lord, or emulate me as I imitate Christ. But how do you know if they're following the Lord if you can't see the Lord in the process? You have to have your eyes always on the Lord. Then you can see where the church leaders, the ministry workers, then you can see where they are in relation to where the Lord is. But never take your eyes off the Lord and just follow the 7'4" guy in front of you. Keep your eyes on the Lord at all time. And in this specific that we're reading, this accomplishes something else as well by doing it this way, by creating this 3,000-foot buffer space. What it does is it makes sure that every person among the nation of Israel gets to see the epic miracle that is going to take place around the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is going to be center stage for this miracle. And it would give the nation a very good chance to witness it with their eyes. Or, I don't know, maybe the Lord just wanted a 3,000-foot buffer of space so that people wouldn't keep pestering the priests. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we? I don't know. Maybe that's possible. Not really. Verse 5. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. Joshua tells them, tomorrow, a miracle. Matter of fact, plural. Miracles are going to happen. The Lord's going to do miracles. Wonder what would happen to our attendance if I announced that prior to a Sunday morning service. Or even a Wednesday night. Wonder what would happen to our attendance. Hey, the Lord's going to do miracles in our service. I bet you attendance would be pretty good. Well, the truth is the Lord's always doing miracles in our services. It just becomes a question of what we value as a miracle, what we identify as a miracle. But tomorrow, the Lord will do wonders among you. Consecrate yourselves. He doesn't say educate yourselves on how to build a bridge to cross the Jordan River. He doesn't say sharpen your swords and hone your skills so that you're ready for the battle in Jericho. Instead, on the eve of this third night, Joshua says, consecrate yourselves. And that is the Hebrew word kadosh, and it means to dedicate, and it also includes everything involved in dedication, which would be ceremonial purification. So we could use a bunch of different words to define this. We could use words like consecrate, dedicate, purify, sanctify, set apart. Those are Bible words that are used quite often, all stemming from this one word, kadosh. Now, those are all good replacement words, and it's enough to tell us that Joshua wants their only preparation for this river crossing on this night to be spiritual in nature. He doesn't care anything about the physical things. No running the treadmill to get in shape. He only is concerned about the spiritual matters on this night. That would be matters of the heart, matters of the spirit. This is not going to be about expertise. It's not going to be about skill, energy, effort. It's not going to be about any of those physical things. It's going to be about preparation of the heart before God. The Lord was going to perform miracles the following day, and miracles do not make your heart right with God. They don't. If they did, Joshua would say it like this. He would have said, tomorrow the Lord will do wonders in among you, and that's going to get your heart right with God. That's going to consecrate you. Instead, Joshua said, no, you consecrate yourself first so that you're ready for the miracle. Get your heart right with God so that when God does the miracles, your heart that's right with God will do the right things with those miracles. And don't think that doesn't matter. It does matter. Because I'll tell you what happens when a heart is not right with God. No amount of miracles is going to convince them to make their heart right with God. It doesn't work that way. It's amazing how a heart that's not right with God can explain away the most impossible of miracles. No problem at all explaining miracles away or just flat out rejecting miracles. And it's all because the heart isn't right with the Lord. But if it starts at the heart, and if the heart is right first, then it's going to do the right things with the miracles that God does in your life. And what a beautiful result comes from that. A heart that is right with God, miracles that are done, and then miracles that are held properly in the regard of the heart. Verse 6, and Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. So this goes right along with verse 3. The people were told that they were going to see the Ark. And now Joshua tells the priests, grab the Ark, pass before the people. I want to make sure the people see the Ark of the Covenant. Take it through the camp. This is important. And a couple of interesting tidbits about verse 3 and verse 6 here is that we see that the Levitical priests are carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Now, be careful, not Levites. Levites aren't carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Levitical priests are carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Now, all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. You remember how this works, I hope. We've just been through all those studies in I don't want to say agonizing detail, a thorough detail. If you were a Levite, you could work around the tabernacle, but you couldn't be a priest and work in the tabernacle. Only the descendants of Aaron, which was from the line of Levi, but only the descendants of Aaron could serve as priests. And here's what we studied in the book of Numbers, in case you forgot. I think it's around chapter 4. The Kohathites, which were a clan from the tribe of Levi, the Kohathites, though they could not be priests, they were tasked with carrying the Ark of the Covenant. But here's how it worked. They weren't allowed to see the Ark of the Covenant. They weren't allowed to touch the Ark of the Covenant. So when it was time for the nation to get up and mobile, the priests would have to go in there and they'd have to cover up the Ark of the Covenant. They'd have to stick those poles through the rings on the four corners so that when it was ready, when it was covered, packed away, and ready to go, then the Kohathites, the Levites, could come in. They could grab those rods and they could carry it by the corners and they wouldn't touch the Ark itself and they wouldn't see the Ark itself. That's how it was supposed to be and that's how it was always done when the Ark of the Covenant was to be moved here. But in this case, it's different. It isn't the Kohathites bearing the Ark of the Covenant. It is the priests themselves. They are carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And if that doesn't grab you, then I think you need to go back and listen to all of those teachings that I did in Exodus and Leviticus again, because you missed it. And that's an important detail. It tells us a few things. It tells us that the Ark of the Covenant was supposed to be uncovered for this river crossing. This is completely new. No one would have expected the Lord to say this or do this, because it was always to be covered. And it means that this would be the first time that anyone other than the high priest and the people that made the ark at the beginning, it would be the first time that anyone other than those men would see the Ark of the Covenant. The first generation never saw the Ark of the Covenant. Second generation, up until this time, they had not seen the Ark of the Covenant, but now the Lord is going to let the commoners see it. And it had to be usually completely covered and packed away, carried by the Kohathites. Completely different now. Completely different. And I think you're going to see why as we get through this story. Verse 7, the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you." He's speaking to Joshua. This is the Lord speaking. So he says, "Today I will begin to exalt you, Joshua, in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you." So there are a couple reasons why this crossing needs to happen. Practically, of course, the people need to cross the Jordan and get on the other side, but this isn't just practical. I think if the Lord wanted to just be practical about this, he could have come up with some other ways. Personally, I really like the zip line idea. Really super. You just get one guy across, send him over on a raft, get one guy across, and he takes the rope with him. You got a zip line, man, piece of cake. Bridge building, build a ferry. I don't know. There's lots of ways that the Lord could have had them do this practically, and he could have just said, okay, you know, work on this. This is how you're going to cross the Jordan. Take your time, man. Just get it done. Keep it safe. But this isn't about being practical. This is about being spiritual. God wants a miracle crossing because he doesn't just want to get them across. The Lord wants to get some things across to them. And one of the things that the Lord wants to get across to them is regarding the leadership of Joshua, which we just read in verse 7. He doesn't want there to be any question that Joshua is God's choice as the replacement for Moses. You know the nightmare that Moses went through with the nation questioning his authority, questioning his right to be in that position and lead the nation. His own sister and brother challenged that authority. And the Lord is saying, no repeats of that kind of behavior from the nation. I'm going to make it real obvious from the beginning, even though he did the same kind of things with Moses. Didn't work on the first generation, but the Lord is trying it again with the second generation, and he's saying, I don't want there to be any questions about the leadership of Joshua. He's my pick, and I have anointed him for that position. So what this really does, what this accomplishes for Joshua, is essentially the same thing that it was supposed to accomplish for Moses. This is supposed to give Joshua supernatural credentials in the eyes of the people. You know how every church, they want their pastor to have seminary degrees, right? Well, this is Joshua's Masters of Divinity. These are supernatural credentials that the Lord is giving so that he will not be questioned, hassled, and challenged in his authority as was Moses. Verse 8, "And as for you, Joshua, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan." Now, you have to admit, in ordinary circumstances, this would sound a bit questionable. You know, Joshua saying, all right, priests, here's what's going to happen. Look, we're all going to be a half a mile away, but we want you guys to run up there and head for the Jordan River. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to step into the Jordan River, and here's the good part. Just wait. And they would be like, wait for what? A surprise. Well, that's the way I'd have handled it. But because we all know everything is better when it's a surprise. Everything. So Joshua's not going to do that. He's going to give them the full story here. He's going to just unveil this whole plan so that by the time this is actually happening, the nation knows what the Lord is going to do. That always helps, doesn't it? To know what the Lord is going to do. Man, I don't get that too much. How about you? Usually I don't know what the Lord's going to do until he done did it. Then I know. But, well, he says in verse 9, "And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God." Verse 10. "And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites." Verse 11, "Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan." Verse 12, "Now therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man." And stop there real quick, because Joshua does not say what he wants these 12 men for until chapter 4. For now, all they know is that Joshua wants each tribe to pick a man for some kind of special thing. I don't know, something's going to happen. They're being volunteered for something. They have no idea what's coming, but they're being picked right now, and we're going to find out what they're for in a while, next 2 weeks from now in chapter 4. So that's a little scary, right? That's like, you know, anytime someone up on the stage says, "Can I have a volunteer?" And here, this needs to be your answer. No, no, not until we know what we're volunteering for. You know, I don't want sawn in half. I don't want axes thrown at my head. These poor guys don't know what they're being selected for. So I don't know. Do you pick your best guy? Do you pick your worst guy? Maybe the Lord's going to get rid of someone. Who knows? Verse 13. "And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan." Let me put that to you another way. When the priests walk into the water and then stop, when their feet are completely covered by water, which would be about ankle deep, once they reach that point, "the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap." Now that's pretty cut and dry, pun intentional. This is called wetting the feet of your faith. The Lord is not going to ask them to go in over their head. All he's going to ask them to do is take some steps of faith and get their feet wet. That is all that Jesus has ever asked of us as well. All he requires from us is mustard seed faith, and that is enough to accomplish mountainous miracles, because it's the Lord doing the work. It's not your faith doing the work. All he needs is that little bit, and that's enough for him to work with. And that is enough for you to get started with. And once you get started with just that little bit of faith, it's amazing the mountains that the Lord can move, and it's amazing the growth that he can give you in your faith. So it's basically like this. You take these steps of faith. It's all the Lord needs, and the Lord is going to take over from there. So, the Lord wants to do a miracle now. He wants to cement their faith in his promises concerning Canaan land. This is like the promise proof. It's the sign. The Lord's saying, what I'm about to do is going to serve as a little bit of help for your faith, that if I would do this for you, then I'm going to do anything that's necessary to bring about the promises while you're in the land. Reminds me of a verse in the New Testament like this, Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. "He who begun a good work in you is faithful to complete it, to finish it until the day of Christ." He didn't bring them this far to fail them. That's what's being said here. Or as Moses says in Deuteronomy, "I brought you out to bring you in." In other words, I didn't bring you out of Egypt just to abandon you or fail you. I brought you out to bring you into the promises of God. And that's the kind of thing that Philippians 1, verse 6 is reassuring us as Christians. God did not bring you out just to fail you. He brought you out of the bondage of the world. That's where he found you, right? He brought you out of the bondage of the world. He set you free from your sin. But he did that in order to bring you into the promises of God. Now, one more thing before we take on the next verse here. Though this is similar to the parting of the Red Sea, the cutting off of the Jordan does have its differences. With the Red Sea, God had to part the Red Sea, and for the most part, the Red Sea was motionless water. It was a sea. So if God just cut the thing and held up one wall of water, what would happen? Well, the other side, the water on the other side would just flow right up against it. So God had to part it. He had to put two invisible lines in the water where the water on one side could not pass and the water on the other side could not pass. That is not needed for the parting, or I should say the cutting off of the Jordan, because the Jordan, for the most part, let me say that a different way. The Jordan was not at all a motionless body of water as the Red Sea was for the most part. That's what I meant to say. It was a flowing river, and at this time of year, as we're going to see, it was a raging river. All God has to do is just chop. All he has to do is draw an invisible line. You know, the same God that tells the tides where to stop, where to rise, and where, the same God that sets the limits and the lines for all of the bodies of water on the earth is the same God that in this moment would cut the Jordan River and draw up an invisible line that he would not allow that water to cross. And the water that would be south of that line would just flow on. It would just go on its way, run its course, flow down the river. And that would all be drying out, right? And then everything on the north of where the Lord draws that invisible line, what's going to happen is that those waters are just going to keep stacking up. It doesn't stop the waters from, you know, God didn't like take the temps down to 10 below and freeze the water. He didn't stop the water from moving. All of that water is gushing down the Jordan, but then when it reaches that spot, the Lord says, no further than that. And the water is just backing up. We're going to read it in a second. That's what's happening here. So the Jordan isn't parted. It's not cut in half. The Lord just simply cut off and stopped up the flow of the Jordan. Now, it is no less miraculous for the Red Sea. God parted largely motionless water. For the Jordan, God had to bring continuous raging water to a stopping point. It's every bit as powerful and wonderful of a miracle. Verse 14, so when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan, now just notice real quickly, the people leave their tents behind here. Now, it's true, they're not going to need them in the promised land. They're going to start conquering cities right away. My goodness, you conquer one city, boom, pick your house. So they're not going to need their tents anymore in the promised land. Well, I mean, at least not for 7 days, but they're going to spend 7 days waiting for the walls of Jericho to fall. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, a tent would come in real handy for 7 days there in Gilgal, staring at Jericho. But nevertheless, what I appreciate here is that they do a clean break from their desert wandering years. I just love that. You know, Paul said in Philippians chapter 3, verse 13, one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. I like that. It's just a clean break from the past. This is all new. We're a different people. God's leading us differently. This is a fresh start. Just leave everything behind and step into what the Lord is providing for you on the other side. So they step out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people. Verse 15, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water. And now we get a little parenthetical insert here. Now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. And that was the sneak peek from last week. That was the tidbit that I shared with you last week about the Jordan River. Ordinarily, the Jordan River at this time was approximately 12 feet deep in the region that they would be crossing. Again, it's not as deep now because there is so much water diverted from the Jordan north of this region where the crossing took place. So it's a completely different kind of landscape. But 12 feet deep in this section throughout the majority of the season, and it would be a river much narrower than the Yauk. So us Pennsylvanians would go over there, take a look at the Jordan and say, that ain't no river, that's a crick. And we would say crick because any good, self-respectable Pennsylvanian says crick and not creek. But I said self-respectable, so my point stands. If you ain't one of us, you ain't one of us. But during the harvest time, completely different thing. During the harvest time, this was, like I shared with you last week, it could overflow in spots up to a mile wide. That's a ridiculous thought. But this would become a dangerous river, a raging river, a scary thing to have to face. So during this time of year at harvest, during flood season, this was a scary river. Verse 16, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away. That's telling you it is backing itself up at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. And seeing that, I'm sure you can imagine the people of Jericho at this point were soiling their garments. I mean, they just had to be. They're already petrified of the nation of Israel, and they're sitting there on their wall watching this unfold. You know, guys, are you seeing this? Yep. I'm packing. I'm out of here. This is scary stuff. This is the only time in the Bible that you're going to see the city of Adam mentioned. Scholars think they have identified where this city is. If they are correct, it would be about 16 to 20 miles north of the spot of the crossing. So that is a long distance for the water to be backing up, but it's only logical. Just imagine an invisible Hoover Dam. You know, it's like the Hoover Dam without the dam, and water just stopping at a point, and no water can cross that line. But again, this isn't a lake. This isn't a sea. This is a raging river at this time of the year. So those waters just keep pouring down, backing up and stacking up. I wish I knew, and I'll find out one day in heaven just how many thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of water were gushing toward the nation of Israel, trying to kill them, only to be stopped by the Lord, because the Lord wouldn't let that happen. So, again, the God who sets tidal boundaries, draws up the lines of the earth, he puts this temporary, invisible line here. And what I love is that the water obeys God. You read that a lot in the Bible. The natural elements obey the words of God. The animal life obeys the word of God. The only part of God's creation that does not instantly, without question, obey him would be, yep, you. Well, I mean, not just you. Not just this church. It's not like a church problem. Us, people, right? Now, this might be a stretch, bear with me, but I just can't help but to make the connection. Water flowing from the city of Adam would normally make this passage impossible for them, and so it is in relation to the human being, in my opinion. That which flows from the city of Adam, that is our carnal nature, that is what keeps us from salvation and the promises of God. That's our obstacle. That's the water that's always flowing in our life. That's the reason why there's not one that seeks after God, no, not one. That's why there's none righteous, no, not one. We have this water flowing from the city of Adam, our carnal nature that comes from the fall, and that is the obstacle that prevents us from getting to God. So in order for a soul to cross over with the Lord and be a partaker of the divine nature, what does it take? It takes a miracle crossing. It takes a miracle from the Lord to stop that flow and to put a new nature in us, to give us a new heart, a heart of flesh, as the Old Testament says. and bring us into the righteousness of God. It's a miracle, and I would say it's a greater miracle than the crossing of the Jordan. I love these stories. They build my faith. It's awesome to think about and visualize. It is even greater to me when I see a soul that is brought into the kingdom that was dead in trespasses and sins. And it is for that reason that all of heaven rejoices at the crossing over of one soul from the wickedness and the world into the righteousness of God. Verse 17. I think we're going to get through this chapter. Verse 17. Now the priest bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground. Same thing as the crossing of the Red Sea. They didn't cross over on mushy ground. They didn't cross over in swampy land. They crossed over in dry ground, which means God took all of the water. Not just the water that was above the soil, but he took all of the water, even the water that was in the soil, and he took and he stood that up and he cut it off, and the ground itself was dry. And they stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Now, since we're 2 weeks away, I want to give you a little sneak peek about something here. In chapter 4, let's see if I can find it real quickly. This is kind of like a little bit of a spoiler, and I wasn't going to bring it out today, but since it's 2 weeks away, if I can find it, I'm going to. Why don't you all just take five and give me a few here? I can't find it, but somewhere in this passage, we're told about the nation of Israel passing over the Jordan, and it says they did so in haste. I really like that. I love that word, and I love its application there. They're crossing over the Jordan River. They see the Hoover Dam there without the actual dam itself, this water stacking up, fish, you know, swimming to the water, sticking their heads out and going, what in the world is happening here? And they see all of this happening, And they have the faith to cross over, but it's the kind of faith where you're like, let's just do it quickly. Because, yes, the Lord is holding back the water. We see that. The question is God giving us a time limit? Let's not push that. So let's cross in haste. And I think I might be in that same camp. Lord, I got enough faith to cross, but I don't got enough faith to drag my feet on this. I'm going to hurry. It's in verse 10. Thank you. All right, let's read it. Verse 10. For the priest bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded. No, that's not it. Oh, there we go. Yeah, there it is. Joshua commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, the people passed over in haste. I just love that. They got the faith to pass over, but not slow. All right, I don't know where you are, but I'm the same kind of guy. I got the faith to pass over, just not slow. Now, for those who study the Bible and try to explain away its miracles with a naturalistic approach, they are grasping for straws, and it is passages like this, like entire passages like this, that really give those approaches no leg to stand on. Those who would explain away the parting of the Red Sea or the crossing of the Jordan River, they ignore the whole point of this. The whole point of this was that God purposed to do something absolutely impossible, an absolute supernatural miracle, so that no one would witness it and say, well, oh, well, that happens every time of year at the same time, you know, the Jordan overflows its banks, and then the wind blows in, and it thins out the water. And yeah, every time, about this time of year, every year you can cross over. The Lord wanted this to be something so demonstrable to display his power that no one would try to explain this away or understand it for anything other than what it was, and that was an act of the power of God. And it's moments like this that miracles like this end up serving as guideposts for us in our life. And that is the direction that chapter 4 is going to take us. We're going to learn that this is a momentous occasion. This is a guidepost for them. And they're going to memorialize it. It's the Lord's way of saying, look, stuff like this isn't going to happen every day. I'm not going to do a gigantic miracle like this for you every day. So if you're the kind of person that needs coddled in your faith, if you need something, you know, if you're the kind of person where, God, what have you done for me lately? Well, you're in trouble, because this is a big thing and it's a guidepost for your future. So that when I'm not doing these gigantic miracles every day, you can still look back when you find yourself in a troublesome spot. You can look at that guidepost. You can think back to what I did, and it can be a confidence for you in the future. I just can't help but to think about some Christians that they just seem to be fevered over the next miracle, just chasing after miracles. It seems to me, from an outside perspective, that that's all they care about. What is the Lord going to do next? What's the next miracle? Can I be a part of it? And I start to wonder, do they love God, or is it simply just that they love his miracles? Well, the Lord wasn't going to let that be an issue for the nation of Israel, and at Anchored Fellowship, we're not going to let that be an issue either, because I'm just not going to perform any miracles. None at all. If there are going to be miracles, it's going to be because the Lord did them. But not me. I'm sticking to my guns on that one. All right, let's stand and close in a word of prayer. No one's going to be here next Wednesday, right? Alan, you're coming? He raised his hand. Well, now I know no one else will be here. All right, we got that covered.